This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal learning space where you and I get 28 minutes with the top experts to understand a big issue. This week, the Russian invasion has turned into a brutal war of attrition. What more can be done to help Ukraine survive it? A month after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what was supposed to be a lightning campaign has turned into an exhausting and bloody war of attrition. Fighting a war like this, especially if you're the smaller, weaker side, is desperately hard. From missiles to energy embargoes, what more can and could the West be doing to help Ukraine survive this battle? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's start in the obvious place with military aid. Western countries have pledged billions of pounds worth of weapons for Ukraine. But President Zelensky recently told Boris Johnson that Ukraine is getting through in 20 hours what is supplied in a week. So what more can be done to help? Gustav Gressel is a senior policy fellow specialising in security with the Wider Europe programme at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Gustav Gressel, billions of dollars worth of military aid has already been pledged to Ukraine. Do we know how much of that pledge material has actually got through to Ukrainian military hands?
Well, actually, quite a lot. I mean, first, there are sort of the military aid that is delivered in arms, and that works quite well. So the supply lines from Europe into Ukraine are open. The Russians try to interdict, but that doesn't happen. And then, of course, there is, in terms of money provided to the Ukrainian armed forces, its salaries have increased in Ukrainian military personnel. That is one big post. And the other thing is sort of domestic produced ammunition, particularly ammunition and vehicle upgrades for the Ukrainian armed forces, which they do in Ukraine.
So to be clear, there's actual material, in other words, the famous anti-tank weapons and anti-air weapons that have gone in. That's one element. Direct money so the Ukrainians can pay their soldiers, assistance for them to produce their own ammunition and to upgrade their vehicles. Do we know whether or not more or less everything that has been promised in terms of the equipment has actually been delivered?
Well, we have now very new pledges who will be delivered in the coming days. But from the past deliveries, most of which was promised has been delivered. There are, of course, issues with a sort of elderly stocks. So I give you an example here from Germany. Germany promised Ukraine to provide 2,700 old Eagle, so first to air, and these are shoulder-launched weapons. They were part of the former GDR's People's Army stocks, and they were kept in Germany. And so far, only 500 have been delivered. Why? Well, if you sort of look at the reason why these weapons have been in stock in Germany, up to this date, Germany didn't want to sell them abroad to sort of uncertified customers or customers who are rumored or phoned to resell them because such weapons could be used, for example, by terrorist groups to attack airliners. So they weren't sold. On the other hand, these missiles are old and all our sort of EU NATO allies don't want these old missiles. So they basically were left to rot in order to spare Germany of the problem in having keeping them. And of course, now basically we suddenly discovered demand for them. But out of the 2,700 that are in stock on paper, only a very few are really serviceable.
One of the things that's been said fairly recently is that the Ukrainians are getting through stocks of equipment pretty quickly because you're now in a kind of significant war of attrition. Are we replacing the stuff that they're using quickly enough?
That is a very good question. I fear we are on some issues, we are a bit late. So we are replacing spent ammunition on anti-tank, light anti-aircraft weapons, which is good. But on the countryside, Ukrainians fight with tank, armored vehicles, etc. And they have also heavy losses. And on resupplying them with tanks, resupplying them with artillery, this is something we have given little thought about, because before the war and right after the war started, we thought that the Russians might break Ukraine's organized military resistance in a couple of days or weeks. And then basically it's a guerrilla war. So we have to give them stuff they can use in a guerrilla war, not a tank and not a complex air defense system. And now they are 1 month into the war and they are very far from being broken. And they're now, of course, running out of heavy Sophester air missiles, and the problems are in resupplying themselves with tanks and artillery and all these big stuff.
So is your expectation that there will now be pledges to give some of that big stuff to Ukraine?
Yes. So especially, of course, our Eastern European allies like Poland, Czech Republic, Romania, they're giving this a thought. Some vehicles already have been spotted. They have the same generation or the same systems that the Ukrainians have, or sometimes they have a bit modified versions. So they can deliver stuff without Ukrainians being in need of changing their logistics, training extensively, etc. For Poland, particularly as they are themselves facing a difficult situation with aggressive Russia and Belarus sitting basically next to them, this effort actually could be aided if we would deploy larger forces from Western European countries into Poland to ease their own burden of being ready for Russian provocations.
Right. So NATO deployment to countries like Poland, some people might look at that and think, well, that's a bit of a waste of time. But actually, it's not a waste of time because it helps the Poles supply the Ukrainians.
Yes. The Polish army or the Romanian army, they on a large extent rest on vehicles in their own armed forces that Ukraine would now, of course, dearly need. If we kind of generate security vacuums, or they generate security vacuums by supplying Ukraine, somebody has to make good for that.
Let me ask you about the supply lines, because if we know that supply lines are being used to give material to Ukraine, then the Russians know it. Now, you mentioned earlier that they were having some difficulty interdicting those supply lines. Will that problem continue, or will they get better at stopping supplies coming through?
One critical element is our Ukrainian air defense units, who are very active, especially in the West. So if you see how the Russians have struck infrastructure that they think or suspect of being used for the supply effort, they resort to standoff weapons.
By standoff, we mean missiles that are coming from a long way away. In other words, they won't fly their planes directly over to drop bombs on them.
Exactly. They don't fly their planes, not only not to drop bombs, but also to spot things. And the kind of information cycle they have with their cruise and ballistic missile launchers is fairly long. So they usually strike things long after they have been used for the supply effort. And that is sort of the reassuring thing of the situation now, is that the Russians have difficulties in tracking these shipments in time and striking them in time. However, of course, we have seen that sort of a heavy surface-to-air missiles, the Americans want to supply Ukraine with ammunition they have got in their stock, and they are in negotiations with a few NATO countries that have these missiles in their stocks. There are only very few of them. These are, of course, crucial for putting up the threat to the Russian Air Force not to come to these regions. And we really have to think about not only supplying them with existing missiles, but what if these missiles then finally drain and run out? Are there systems we can train the Ukrainians quickly on, and which are sort of usable in terms of training effort, that we can supply them? Because we should start that now if we only sort of assess the current need and don't think ahead, we might run into real difficulties by later spring.
Gustav Gressel, one thing that might help Ukraine is if Russia runs out of money soon. Never mind oligarchs, the big ticket item here is energy exports. Can Ukraine's allies get out of buying gas and oil from Russia anytime soon? Javier Blas is energy and commodities columnist at Bloomberg and co-author of The World for Sale. Javier Blas, how much does the West pay for Russian oil and gas every day?
Well, at current oil and gas prices, the number comes somewhere between $800 million and $1 billion a day.
How does that break down between gas and oil?
Well, most of it is coming from oil. Oil is the big cash cow for the Russian Federation. So around $600 million is oil, and that's not just Europe or the UK. It's worldwide, so that includes the oil that is flowing into China, India, and other emerging countries. And then around $200 million is gas, and that's going primarily into the European Union.
Right. Now, can we split these down even further and say what proportion of that 800 million on oil and gas is, if you like, kind of Western alliance, i.e. countries that are aligned with Ukraine and want to see the invasion defeated?
Conservatively, at least half, if not 75%, is from what we could call countries that they are with Ukraine and against the invasion of Russia.
Now, if there were a way of stopping all Russian imports tomorrow from those countries specifically, what impact would that have on the Russian economy?
Well, it will be a huge economic impact because oil and gas account for around 50% of all what Russia is exporting, is the main way that is still earning hard currency, foreign exchange that can use to pay for other things. And it's also at least 40% of the income of the government. So cut that, and you are really knocking down the Russian economy very, very hard. Certainly a lot harder than all these sanctions that we are putting on the oligarchs, which are really make us feeling well, because it's something that you could see happening, and you know, you could name and shame the oligarchs and think, well, probably this could have an impact on them and on Putin. But at the end of the day, that doesn't really have a lot of impact on the Russian economy and on the ability of the Russian government to finance itself. Oil and gas will really knock down their economy.
Now, once again, theoretically, if we were able to turn off their taps to us immediately and substitute, how quickly would it take, do you think, for the Russian economy effectively to cease to be able to operate its war machine?
That is going to take time, because the problem is that Russia has significant savings in the form of foreign exchange that his central bank has accumulated. And even if we have already cut access to a portion of that, they still have money in Russia. And also, President Vladimir Putin seems to be very strongly minded that he is going to carry on no matter what the economic cost of the war is for him. But certainly in a few weeks, potentially a couple of months, the Russian economy will be in absolute disarray if we were to cut oil and gas. They will be in massive trouble. The key question is, will that massive trouble translate in President Putin saying, okay, I'm going to seek a ceasefire or even exit Ukraine? That I don't know.
Let's now look at the other side of the equation. Could you give us an idea of what the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz meant when he talked about the impact of any such sudden cutoff on European economies being devastating?
It will be an economic recession the size of what we suffered during COVID. It will be massive inflation, significantly higher than what we are suffering today. It will mean that current petrol and diesel prices that feel very, very high will look like bargains. It will mean that oil prices that they are currently trading around $120 a barrel probably will go a lot closer to $200 a barrel. It will really mean that we will suffer at the West huge economic consequences, and everything will get very expensive. And for countries like Germany, there is also the potential of not just high prices, but actual shortages. Perhaps not enough diesel for the trucks, and perhaps not even enough electricity. And that is why some governments in Europe, particularly the German, are very reluctant to go that way. And certainly if they go that way, they want to do it in phases rather than all sanctions in one go.
So in other words, Europe, particularly those countries that have significant gas contracts with Russia, would potentially face not just the higher prices, but actual blackouts because of a lack of availability of power for electricity.
Yeah, if you do not have enough gas, you are going to have to cut somewhere. First, we will try to reduce consumption in the industry, particularly intensive energy industries. And Germany has lots of them, fertilizers, chemical industry, that will be cut off. But at some point, you don't have enough gas. You have to start reducing electricity supply. And that potentially means just having at least rolling blackouts. It is a big deal to cut off completely Russian gas from Europe.
Can you give me an idea, and I know this is a really difficult question, of a timescale within which you could cut off your dependence upon Russian oil and gas without having disastrous consequences? How long might such a program take?
It's probably the rest of the year. So from now until December of 2022, you do it, say, about 5-10% every month reduction. That is something that it will be manageable. It will be expensive. Don't get me wrong. We will still face very high prices and higher prices certainly than now. But we will not suffer the devastating impact of physical shortages of energy, which will be a big problem for the economy.
Would you say that that is the way in which Europe is likely to go? That it's likely to do this stage step down, which will be very costly for it, but in order to avoid the disastrous consequence of a sudden cutoff?
We have had already four rounds of sanctions in the European Union that didn't touch energy. Negotiations currently are on the fifth package. Diplomats are telling me that once we do the fifth package or the fifth round, we will have more or less exhausted anything that we can really sanction in Russia that is meaningful. So the next thing, the obvious thing to go is for energy. And I think that a phased approach is probably the way to go.
Javier, a quick question about the UK. Of course, we don't import a lot of Russian gas, but we are susceptible to whatever happens in the oil market. How would we be impacted by any significant boycott of Russian energy?
We in the UK are going to be impacted as our friends in the continent, no matter what. The price is a global price. So if gas prices go significantly higher because countries like Germany or the Netherlands are cutting on Russian gas, that will have also a similar impact in terms of prices in the United Kingdom. And the same goes with oil, perhaps exacerbated by the fact that the UK actually does import quite a lot of refined product, and in particular diesel. We are all exposed no matter what we are buying.
Javier Blas. A country under siege is a country in need of humanitarian aid. So what more can be done to help? Dr. Sarah Schifling is International Research Fellow at the Humanitarian Logistics Institute in Helsinki, Finland, and Senior Lecturer in Supply Chain Management at Liverpool John Moores University. If you could categorise the most vital forms of humanitarian aid to Ukraine right at this moment, what would you say they were?
There's a lot of demand for medical products and food aid as well. However, we need to be careful about blanket statements here, since demands will differ very much depending on where you are, what the situation is right now. Are they connected to drinking water still, or do they need water brought in? So it differs depending on the location.
Is it your impression that the Russian invaders regard it as being in their interest to allow humanitarian supplies to get through to what we call besieged cities?
So when you're besieging a city, obviously it's not in the interest of the besieging army to let through supplies. That kind of contradicts the entire reason why you would be besieging a city. But it is definitely against humanitarian law to attack civilians, to inflict such suffering as we are seeing from cities like Mariupol at the moment.
One of the things I think that a lot of listeners might be wondering, particularly older ones who remember references to something like the Berlin airlift, is it really impossible for us to airlift in significant supplies to besieged cities?
Airlifting is very difficult for the exact same reasons that we've heard about why NATO doesn't consider closing the skies over Ukraine. You would have aircraft over Ukraine and they would make quite easy targets then. So what we are seeing right now is not an air bridge as we had to Berlin, but we are seeing a rail bridge. So German company DB Cargo is having a humanitarian rail bridge where they're bringing cargo in by rail at the moment, humanitarian aid cargo, which is great because on rail, you can just transport much larger amounts of cargo in one go than you could in a truck. And we are talking massive amounts of aid. So we do have from the Ukrainian president's office a humanitarian aid dashboard, and that gives really interesting insights. So total that they've got at the moment is about 70,000 tons of humanitarian aid that has reached various parts of Ukraine. Most of that is transported by road, but also about 10,000 tons of that is transported by rail.
What would be the capacity, do you think, to increase that amount and to get it particularly to cities which are almost enclosed?
It's extremely important to keep up the delivery of humanitarian aid. That is something that often happens, that kind of the public attention wanes. It's no longer interesting. It's no longer a news story. And that's really crucial in humanitarian aid, that we don't let that happen. We need sustained attention. We need sustained support, particularly for these cities that are suffering a lot from the attacks right now.
Right. It sounds from what you're saying as if actually the aid line is quite vulnerable.
It is very vulnerable. You're going through territory that's obviously being shelled, where you've got enemy forces all around. So it's very vulnerable. That's why these humanitarian corridors are so important, to actually have reliable lines to evacuate civilians, but also to send supplies in. So that is something where there's lots of negotiations taking place bilaterally, but also where aid agencies, where the UN are really stepping in to try and negotiate that, to try and get access to people.
How important is the straightforward provision of money to Ukraine in allowing them to get the things that they need?
Generally, in humanitarian aid, we always say that cash is best. So cash donations just give us a lot of flexibility, because it's not necessarily always things that people need. So if you're thinking about all those refugees coming out of Ukraine right now, a lot of what they need might be psychological care. It might just be simple things like at a border crossing to have a heated waiting room and toilet facilities. And that's not necessarily things that we can donate. So on the donation side, it would always be cash is king. Cash is the best way to help. But on giving people cash directly, that really depends on whether or not they're able to spend it.
Now, we're talking about the situation in which this conflict continues for a long time, regrettably. As we look to the longer term, what long-term humanitarian assistance is going to be required?
Longer term, we're looking at rebuilding and having longer-term structures in place. So right now, humanitarian agencies are in the process of setting up a network of distribution warehouses. So shipments don't need to come in and immediately be distributed, but you've got central warehouses that can then distribute out depending on need. So that's very important, to set up a bit more of a permanent network to be able to help people as quickly as possible. And that will grow over the coming weeks, month, whatever the situation might be. And then it's also a question of obviously helping the people that have fled Ukraine and helping them to integrate in their new home countries and arrive there and build new lives, hopefully temporarily, not for too long, but we don't know at the moment.
Sarah Schiffling. Finally, that new frontier of conflict, cyberspace. The battle for cybersecurity and to keep information flowing is a critical part of any conflict. How active are Western agencies on behalf of Ukraine, and can they raise their game? Algirda Pipikaita is a cybersecurity and digital transformation policy expert at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. Algirda Pipikaita, do we know how much cyber support the West has already provided to Ukraine?
What we have observed in this very recent couple of weeks of the ongoing war and pre-war is that the Western community actually came very closely together supporting Ukraine in their cyber preparedness and then cyber response. We've seen the United States of America increasing their humanitarian assistance in Ukraine, specifically allocating funds for cybersecurity. We've seen the European Union mobilizing their team of cybersecurity experts who were helping and are helping Ukraine to prepare and respond to their cyber attacks. And on top of that, we've seen private sector very engaged in supporting Ukraine from providing satellites and satellite connections so that Ukrainian population would have their information and communication restored, from social media companies spending their resources and time educating Ukrainian users on how to protect their social media accounts, including, for example, guiding them on how to disable location tracking so they would be safe. And we also have seen multiple leading technology companies setting up what we call as special operations centers within their own organizations that allows their employees to focus and follow very closely the ongoing events in Ukraine and provide help to customers and users in Ukraine, including the Ukrainian government itself.
The other side of potentially helping Ukraine in cyber terms is doing things that in some sense target Russia or disrupt Russian efforts. Is the West involved in that as far as we know?
What we've seen recently is multiple successful attacks on certain Russian entities, from TV channels to streaming service providers. There were a couple of hacking groups that have claimed responsibility, and they've hacked multiple of news outlet sources, if you may, in Russia.
So there are groups which are targeting Russian social media and so on. There's been some talk in the last week of sending information via unusual cyber channels to Russian citizens regarding what's happening in Ukraine in a way that circumvents the official media. What do you make of that?
We definitely have seen citizens being very creative in how they use technologies to circumvent or provide alternative media outlets. For example, going through TripAdvisor reviews and basically flooding that with the war-associated news, pictures, and text so that the Russian population would have access and would see what's happening across the border.
Looking at the bigger picture, is there anything more in cyber terms that you think that her friends could do to help Ukraine?
Here I would like to mention three potential solutions in how we could provide and support Ukraine. One, I really like to encourage any organization and any company that is working or were working with people, engineers, back office workers, contractors, developers inside Ukraine to continue working with them. It is not a time now to cut contracts and to stop working with the Ukrainian people because they need work and they need income more than ever. Second is to continue providing support to the Ukrainian government in improving and building a robust cybersecurity and cyber defense as EU did, as the US did, and continue that, to not forget continue supporting. And third one, maybe the most technologically driven solution that I can think of after multiple conversations with people on the ground in Ukraine is currently we do not have an ability or a platform to match what are the needs in Ukraine from medical devices and medical supplies and potentially military equipment, technology devices that are needed, to what different donors are willing to provide and support. On top of that, logistically, it's really challenging right now to reach Ukraine. So if one could build a technological platform to match what donors are donating and what the needs of Ukrainian people are in different spots, and top that with logistical support from customs clearance to actual transportation, I think that would do much more good to the Ukrainian people in a short term than any other solution that I could think of.
Algirda Pipikaitin, my thanks to her, Gustav Gressel, Javier Blas and Sarah Schiffler. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirsty Knight, Octavia Woodward and Louise Clark Rowbottom. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Varden. And you can find previous editions of this podcast on BBC Sounds.
Here we go, OT. 5, 6, 7, 8.
Dance. It has the power to connect. and to entertain. And in a new series for BBC Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, I explore the iconic dancers who have been doing just that.
Dance, it really, I think, saved my life.
Join me, Oti Mabuse, as I delve into the lives of the innovators and the mold breakers who have changed dance forever.
Gene Kelly was this working class guy that I just really connected with that.
Oti Mabuse's Dancing Legends on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.